Hi, this is Margaret Byron. I am a lecturer at the University of Leicester. Prior to that, I lectured at King's College London for 16 years. I grew up, as it were, within the Methodist Church. I didn't select the Methodist Church as a place of worship. I don't think I ever did that, although as you become an adult, I suppose you do make that decision to either continue attending church or you sort of withdraw from that process. But I've remained. When I came to England, it didn't occur to me to worship elsewhere. But the Methodist Church has always been in our lives. I think my mum was English, she was a nurse, she was very modern in her interpretation of what children need and what's appropriate for children. Modern at that time, I'm talking about the 1960s and 70s. So she felt strongly that while we were christened in the Methodist Church, we didn't go to church until we could behave ourselves. So we didn't go to church at age 1 and 2 and 3 because she knew there'd be a racket. So we did go to church when a sibling was being christened. But other than that, we were home on a Sunday. And then at the age of 4 or 5, we were taken to church every Sunday with my dad. My mum found that by the time she got 3 little girls ready and combed their hair, that she was usually exhausted. So she'd go to evening service and we tended to go to with Daddy to the morning service. And he was choir master for an awful lot of my life. So we sat upstairs near the choir and behaved ourselves. I grew up in the Leeward Islands, in 2 islands, St. Kitts and Nevis. It was really Nevis. I mean, my father's home was Nevis. He was born in Nevis. I guess their forefathers were arrived in the Caribbean and were bought by planters on the island of Nevis. And that was where our connection with the Caribbean started, largely.
Yes.
We also have lots of relatives in Trinidad because my grandfather was one of 6. And he was the first one, and then his mother died and his father got another wife. And the younger siblings, his father asked him to accompany them to Trinidad where they were seeking their fortune. Mm-hmm. So Trinidad had more of an economy going. It was more recently colonised by the British. It was colonised by the British about 150 years or more later than St. Kitts and Nevis, which were early colonies in 1625 kind of time.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, he went with them. He didn't like it, found Trinidad far too, it was termed sinful and outrageous, you know, because they were carnivalesque even in those days. They had a lot of French and Spanish influence.
Of course.
And also, interestingly, the plantation agriculture in Trinidad started really late.
Oh.
And so there was much more connection almost with Africa because that people had come within the last century only,
of course. Yes.
As opposed to last century and a half, as opposed to much longer years of African presence in the smaller islands.
Mm-hmm.
I came to England at the end, right at the tip of the 70s, beginning of the 1980s.
Okay.
Yeah, so I came and Mrs. Thatcher had been in power maybe for a year. My mum was English. My mum was from Derbyshire. So she met my dad while they were both in London. She was becoming a highly qualified nurse and health visitor. And she did social work at the studies at the same time. So she was on that front. My dad was studying law and they met. And she elected to go and join him in the Caribbean after he went back. Now, so we had the English input. We had my mum who had a different outlook because she'd come from a different culture and background. But it was English, and of course the Caribbean was very, very British, you know. So we had British passports. We grew up British. But my mum was from a strictly Labour background. Her father was the assistant for George Brown, who was a very famous MP. In Derbyshire. But when I came to England, I went to live with a cousin who lived short time in Leeds. And I saw how Caribbean people had settled in urban areas of the UK. I didn't understand for a while how literally, you were put in a box and you were expected to function as to how the state expected you to function, wanted you to function.
Yes.
But I came from a country that was nearing independence where the way to succeed was either to migrate or to do extremely well at school.
Yes.
So every bright child was encouraged, no matter how poor you were, no matter how, if you were bright, every effort would be made to give you a chance. And so Caribbean kids succeeded because we were in a black majority country. We, you know, there's no question that somebody could say, oh, you're going to be a factory worker because you're black. That just didn't happen. So when I came to Leeds now, and these kids were not achieving, and I worked, I got a job as a lab technician in Leeds, in a school.
Yes.
Primrose Hill in Leeds. Still right there by St. James's Hospital. Sure, it's still there. And it was bang in the middle. It was next to Chapel Town, which was the big Caribbean area. Yes. It was also, that area was also very, very Indian. There was a big Sikh community. There's also a big Pakistani community. So, yeah. Different issues with each community and so on. There's about probably a third of the school body was white working class.
Yes.
Definitely not white middle class people in there. Only white middle class people were the teachers. And they were all white middle class. It's really interesting for me. And I used to get very angry with the black kids. I mean, why the hell are you doing general science? Why the hell are you succeeding? And not realizing, why don't you have the kind of ambition that kids had back home? My best friends were poor. My best friend never had electricity going to school. Never.
Mm.
You study by the light of a kerosene lamp, you know? And those people went on and ended up with their masters from McGill University in Canada and, you know, and went to the University of the West Indies because we were in a cohort of very bright kids, you know? There were kids who weren't super academic, but you were encouraged if you were academic. Here was it, in a country where, to me, all the education was, all these opportunities were. And these kids were fighting around and messy about in general science classes. And I was angry with them because I had no idea what the structures were that were putting them in that position.
Yeah.
I was going to do rural development. And that was, I had a master's at University of Kent to do rural development. And they'd offered me a scholarship. And in my last few months at the university, it was the University of Plymouth then, I started to see on notice boards, little advertisements for PhDs.
Yeah.
And there were two which were kind of around migration and ethnicity. And it was just really annoying because I knew what I was going to do. I was going to do rural development and I was sorted, right?
Yeah.
And the students used to be quite, holded me in a certain amount of awe because I knew what I wanted.
Yeah.
And here was me, who supposedly knew what I wanted, looking at these. Which was going to take me in a totally different way. The last thing I ever wanted was to be a lecturer or to be an academic.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And I ended up with two scholarships. One to University College Dublin to look at return migration.
Yeah.
With a return migration expert who was very excited to get into the idea of Caribbean return migration.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at return migration to the Mediterranean,
wow,
to Greece and Italy.
Yeah.
So he wanted me to do that. And he was prepared, it was to look at return migration to Ireland.
Yes.
But he was prepared to offer me the scholarship and change it to look at the Caribbean. And the other one was to look at migration, Caribbean settlement, and the different experiences of ethnic minorities within Britain. And he had funding from the Economic and Social Research Council to do that.
Yes.
The other one was Trinity College Dublin, and they were funding the scholarship. Mm. So I had a dilemma of having to make a decision to do a PhD in migration studies of some sort, and then which of those, and to turn down the University of Kent Rural Development course, which would have led me back to the Caribbean many decades ago. And I ended up choosing the Oxford offer and doing my PhD there on Caribbean, post-war Caribbean migration with Professor Kerry Peach, who was a wonderful role model then.
Yeah.
Older mentor and just everything. Mm. He was the most wonderful person. I've always been fairly, what's the word, broad church in that I am interested in the concept of development and how people view development and how people view other places, how they, they assess other places compared to their own place and their own familiarity, things with which they're familiar. And I've been interested in the everyday, people's everyday. So I think if you were to describe me, I'd say I was pretty down to earth. I'm interested in ordinary things. I've not got an awful lot of time for fancy stuff.
Thanks.
So I love interviewing people. I love talking to people about who they are. Yeah, it's really great, isn't it? Fascinating to me just to sit and talk to people. And they talk, so I'm lucky in that they're prepared to answer me for some reason.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it's always a kind of migration and outcomes of migration story for me. That really interests me. So I spend a lot of time talking with students about that. But also, more recently, I've been the chair of the race group in the Royal Geographical Society. Yes. We established this working group to really include the issue of race and the importance of thinking about race.
Yes.
And how race becomes a way of excluding people.
Yeah.
And of how race is also very much about power and who gets to make decisions and who gets to exclude, and how structurally and institutionally people can be excluded.
Absolutely.
Without one individual being racist and setting out to exclude people, but how the system over time excludes and has to change in order to include, you know.
Definitely.
So I'd say my interest in migration has been key to a developing desire to, well, I suppose the other thing is, Deanna, when you get older, you're not afraid anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I have some people tear after me after I've said something in church to say, well, actually, it might have been gender.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're so determined
not to be racism.
For it not to be racism, to kill challenges about racism before they even get off the ground.
Absolutely.
So gender discrimination or even sexuality discrimination is more, it's like society can just about deal with that.
Yes.
But just whatever you do, don't mention race.
And thinking about race, did like the Black Lives Matter movement of 2020, did that change maybe your angle or anything that you were doing in your work or outside of?
I think, in an interesting way, it has made it at times easier to raise issues of race at work. It was interesting. What it means is that you can often discuss it because it was so relevant and so recent. And some people genuinely started to think again and to question and to identify. A lot of people are just very embarrassed and find the whole thing just too much to deal with. Other people became super hostile and are actually saying, well, it's nothing to do with us, and anyway, all these woke people should shut up, and history, what people were doing then was not the way we feel now. We can't blame people who lived in those days, because actually values were different. What? You know? And so on. So, you know, it's interesting, but it's been possible to speak of things that it possibly wasn't possible. It wasn't possible to speak of.
The ears weren't open.
But you still have people challenging what you say and what you think. Yeah. Talking about the church, there's one really interesting incident where we spoke about, I'm always talking about Black Lives Matter in church. No, more so than ever before. But I have spoke, it didn't take Black Lives Matter as a movement to make me speak about race and about how people are made to feel in church. But one of our fellow students even, I met him and I told him, I just said, you know, I went to Leicester's protest. And I remember some people told me, you went, you did what? And I said to them in church, I spoke about it in church. It was, I said, you know, the truth is that we're dying anyway.
Yeah.
And we're dying from things we shouldn't be dying from. Oh, men are dying because they get beaten by the police. Not occasionally.
No.
Not occasionally. They die in prison, they die in police vans, they die... People feel it's okay to keep black men in their heads.
Mm.
You know, so actually, it was important to go out. And actually, it was more important to me to go and demonstrate in town that day than to protect myself against COVID. Because for me, it was just more important. It's about, ultimately, it's about what matters.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely.
But one of my friends at church, he said, you know, Margaret, I was there too. I said, you were there? He said, yeah, I went. You know, I was feeling very down. And he said, what? When that man was killed, he said, it made him feel that he's here, the migrant lady. Yeah. He's here and he works here and he brought his children up here and so. And he said, it struck me that they don't like me. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, you kind of not the same as everybody else. But he said, it became a thing in his head and it was going on. He was getting ill. Mm-hmm. And he said, his team leader at work had to take him aside and sit him down and have a long chat with him because he said, they were aware of the increasing depression.
Wow.
Yeah. But he said, going with his family to the Black Lives Matter movement meant everything to the demonstration. And it never occurred to him to say to me, you went? When all that risk was out there, you went, no, for us. It was something we had to do.